A dwelling is something more than just a house.
Dwelling is an old-fashioned word, I think, that we've misplaced. And what I mean by that is when we dwell, we're really present. We're here. We live heart and soul. We are committed to that place. Essentially, we have possession of it, and it has possession of us. And so, therefore, we dwell.
That's Howard Mansfield. We talk with him about his profound and delightful book, Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. And as we become a country of minorities, including whites, we need to change our outmoded narrative about America.
What it is most important to know is that no one group is uniquely privileged as sort of the makers of American history. That history is really woven together from a lot of strands.
That's Rebecca Stefoff. She's adapted Ronald Takaki's classic study of the multicultural history of America, A Different Mirror, into a book for middle and high school readers. It's called A Different Mirror for Young People. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. What makes a home a place to dwell in, a place that makes us feel happy to be alive? Why do some places invite us in and others feel like soulless boxes? These and many other questions about dwelling are explored by my guest Howard Mansfield in his new book, Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. Its chapters explore such different branches of the question as, how does losing electrical power in a storm change us? The meaning of the destruction of homes in war, the house as a stage for reverie, and how communities are seeking to bring back homes that encourage relationships instead of consumerism. Writing about preservation, architecture, and American history, Howard Mansfield has contributed to the New York Times, American Heritage, The Washington Post, Yankee, and other publications. He's also the author of 6 books, including In the Memory House and The Bones of the Earth. I started out our conversation by asking Howard Mansfield to read a passage from Dwelling in Possibility.
I liked house hunting. I am fascinated by how houses succeed or fail to shelter us, body and soul. I could go from house to house clear across the country, knock on doors and ask, can I come in? Look around? What's your favorite room? Your latest house project? I'd like to see them all. The sour living rooms behind dirty windows and overgrown shrubs. The small rooms made smaller by dark wood paneling, big fat lazy boy recliners, and the large screen TV. McMansions where rooms and rooms leak space. Prim places where the grass is edged, the shrubs are obedient, and inside the couch is under a plastic cover, and the cabinet of curios is dusted and gleams at attention. Houses where the Bible and the baby Jesus are the only ornaments, and guns lie asleep in drawers and cabinets. Houses that are all noise, as if they are cotton candy spun from the loud, always-on TV and the radio giving traffic reports to the resident who doesn't drive. Houses that smell from the morning's bacon all day long, where one breakfast seems to compound the next, as if staleness were compounded daily like old-fashioned passbook savings accounts. Houses that smell of feet or vaguely like diapers, even though the children are in high school. Houses you covet, so airy, so modest in their grandeur. Houses where everything seems to be right. Husband loves wife. Cat loves dog. Tree loves house. House loves view. Houses that are worn and comfortable like an old fielder's mitt, like the sweatshirt and jeans a commuting executive wears on Saturdays. Houses that are mysterious in their blandness. The rooms of furniture set out as expected, as prescribed. But you know no one really lives there. Where's the real life? This is a front. You don't want to see, and you do want to see, the private rooms. Houses that are walled with photos of children, grandchildren, nieces, and grandnieces, the walls of diplomas hanging like battle ribbons. Houses that you pass 100 days, 1,000 days, maybe every day of your life, and no one enters. Even the lawn seems to be self-mowing, the mail self-removing. Houses that command a hill, houses that play hide-and-seek behind trees and shrubs. Houses that seem vulnerable, exposed by a highway exit on a traffic island, backing to a big store parking lot or railroad tracks, the house a goldfish bowl. Houses in which terrible things have happened in daylight. houses in which nothing has happened, and that seems terrible. Houses where the boredom sticks to the yellows the walls like grease from 10,000 meals. Houses that grow old with their inhabitants, roofs and walls and windows, all flaking, peeling, breaking. The house has arthritis. The house is exposed to the world. Houses that spill out toys and bikes and cars and tools and projects, sometimes right to the line of their neighbor's land. Thousands, millions of houses. You drive past them at 1 a.m., 2 a.m., all those people asleep, snoring, dreaming, all in the dark, trusting in the state that no marauders will come in the night.
Yeah, that's just beautiful. And you write, in fact, that the peak of dwelling is poetry. It's a quote from the philosopher Heidegger. But I think you've just shown us the kind of poetry you mean in some ways.
Yeah, it's the poetry of the ordinary, isn't it? It's just it's everyday life. It's the nothing much that is home. It's peace, silence, and dreams. It's clutter. It's the mess on the table or the drawings on the refrigerator wall. It's tumult. It's passing the time with friends. It's the little landmarks of the house, you know, the funny thing your aunt gave you, or the ugly wedding present you can't really part with because it reminds you of somebody. Different things that have just been with you forever.
So tell us, what is the soul of shelter? What do you mean when you say that dwelling is a soul of shelter?
Well, dwelling, which is, you know, obviously in the title of the book, Dwelling and Possibility. Dwelling is an old-fashioned word, I think, that we've misplaced. And what I mean by that is when we dwell, we're really present. We're here. We live heart and soul. We are committed to that place. Essentially, we have possession of it, and it has possession of us. And so, therefore, we dwell.
And yet we've been really getting away from dwelling. We build anti-dwellings, you say. What does it say about a culture that builds houses but not homes?
Yeah, it's a big problem, and it's one of these real divisions. Is that so many ordinary things that were once just very common in the house have changed in the last 100-150 years, so that today I think we're crowding ourselves out of our dwellings, out of our houses. We're crowding ourselves out with clutter, which is just a big obsession of the age, and crowding ourselves out with visual clutter, virtual clutter, I mean, so that we're not really there anymore. We kind of just check into the place, and we find it not satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the more it's not satisfying, the more things people tend to accumulate. It's almost like junk food or junk calories, in a sense. You keep trying to compensate for that, so you move to bigger and bigger spaces and fill it up and move on. You know the extent of that is of just two quick examples of that. At the founding of the country, the average house size was about 700 square feet, which is the size of about a two-car garage, and it was filled with people. Maybe 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 people would be living in that space, and you might have a bowl, a spoon, a table. That would be it. Today, we live in 10 to 14 times the amount of space on average, and it's filled with stuff and few people, maybe 2.3 people on average, and still 1 in 10 families rents a storage shed, and there's more storage sheds in this country than McDonald's now. The Storage Shed Association, the inevitable trade group, says that if every American wanted to, they could shelter under the space of storage shed. So it's a complete reversal. We have things replacing life, stuff replacing life. And the virtual clutter thing is like how much that work has followed people home, and we all have these computers with all these post-it notes on it and all these peripheral things. And the study I saw said that on average now Americans are spending 8.5 hours a day looking at screens. That's television screens, smartphones, GPS, computers. 8.5 hours a day is a heck of a lot of time.
Yeah, you know, what you're talking about reminds me of something I read, you know, about a million years ago. Marx once said that, Karl Marx, that is, said that capitalism brings about a change, that there were, you know, there used to be material relationships between people, and now there are social relationships between things.
Oh, that's really good. And what else he said? He said, your money, now your money can go out and buy the experiences for you.
Right.
Very early in saying that. So your money, which is, you know, the whole so-called experience economy you hear these consultants talk about now. You know, Starbucks doesn't sell you a coffee, they're selling you an experience. The Rainforest Cafe isn't selling you a hamburger, they're selling you an experience. It's just craziness.
And houses are selling us the experience of dwelling without actually being dwelling in some way, like the McMansions.
Is yeah, I think you're right. And I think when you get to the shelter magazines and you get to the all these channels, that's what you're seeing. It's like this kind of manifest destiny of home improvement that you won't be happy unless you have the perfect kitchen, the perfect porch, this new finish, that finish. And, you know, people always say, well, it needs to be updated, which is just kind of a crazy notion that people have married on to.
Right. Well, there are three parts to this wonderful book, Howard Mansfield. The book is called Dwelling in Possibility. There are three parts. One is Dwelling in the Ordinary, which we've just started talking about. Dwelling in Destruction, which is also a fascinating section, and Dwelling in Possibility. Let's go back to the ordinary again. You have a chapter early on about being caught in the ice storm of 2008. Now, that wasn't a very ordinary experience, but it really puts you in the here and now. Your electricity was out for a while. There was an inconvenience, but there was also an upside. Tell us about that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the storm was fierce. I mean, we woke up to the sounds of huge limbs of, you know, 100-year-old and older trees just falling on the house and near the house and crashing down and not knowing when that would stop. And the place, our part of New Hampshire, looked like a tornado had been through. Wires down, trees tipped over, transformers on the ground. And we were without power ourselves for 6 days in the end of December. And what happened once you got past the terror of everything falling onto your house, was that our house, it's not that old a house. It's 1880. We have an old wood stove in part of the house. And so all of a sudden, we began living by the wood stove, the old Vermont Castings wood stove. Back there we were, the old steady reliant stove, feeding it from the wood pile, living by the light of the fire, looking at the fire, discussing what we didn't know because it was nothing but rumors and no information around. And all of a sudden, the entire house was different. It's pre-electric self emerged. The smell of the house and the wood smoke, the colors of the day were completely different in the house because you didn't have electricity. So as the light faded early in 4:30, 4:30, the light in the house changed, and it was just a different spirit in the house. It was kind of terrific in that way, and everybody was released from their routine, so you'd run into people all over the place, and we had wonderful dinners with our neighbors, you know, around candlelight, everybody just salvaging what they could from when everything was melting and ruining, so you might as well eat it. So it was a little bit of like a week and a half long snow day in which you couldn't get email or anything. But it released us to experience more of the present.
Yeah, and just the light, the quality of the light, the quality of the heat. You know, it used to be the hearth was almost synonymous with the home, and yet we don't have hearths anymore unless they're kind of decorative with a couple of gas logs twinkling merrily.
Exactly, and that is the huge change that kind of came home to me, kind of like an aha moment, but more of like aha duh moment for myself, was that, oh my gosh, for thousands of years, we lived first outside by the campfire. We always lived by a campfire, told stories by a campfire, the whole thing. And then when we moved indoors in the Middle Ages, you always have these tales of these huge halls with these smoky fires and birds flying through and bards declaiming the news and everything. And then someone said, let's put that fire under a hood. And then someone said, well, let's make a big fireplace. And this took thousands of years to figure out, you know, how to get the smoke out. And then the fireplace became smaller and actually started generating heat. And then the fire got put into a metal box, the wood stove. And then for most of us, the fire, the hearth disappeared, went into the basement. And that hearth central house really was gone. And this was really disorienting. You've read about it in the Beecher Sisters and other people at the sort of towards the end of the 19th century. It was like a whole spirit had gone out of the house. Houses were warmer, but a spirit had gone, that sense of everybody sitting around the fire or families gathered by the fire, either having great times or getting on each other's nerves, depending on the family. But once the hearth goes out, once the fire goes out, everything is decentralized. Everybody is free with the hearth and central, with the hearth gone, with central heating, with electricity, you don't have to cuddle in one place. Everybody's free to go off to their separate rooms and their own gadgets, and life is decentralized. Life is not as central. And you see the same thing happening in cars today. It used to be, you know, when we were growing up, it'd be like an AM station. Everybody would listen to that or play stupid car games on long trips or annoy your brother. Now you drive past cars and these video screens are down and the kids in the back are just each watching their own video screen or everybody's plugged into their own iPod. It's the same kind of thing, you know. The classic American space, I think, is, you know, cabin in the woods. And the iPod is a cabin in the woods. You're always kind of recreating that isolation.
So what do you think that means for us as a culture? I mean, we're spinning away from each other in so many ways. How do you see that happen? What are the ramifications of that you see for our society?
Well, I think everybody pretty much knows it's like there's a isolation, that sense that people aren't talking to each other, this sense that we think that the next gadget along is going to kind of recreate this for us. I mean, a survey I saw by an academic said that parents and children spend an average of 14.5 minutes a day talking. That's the total, which I guess if you had a teenager would be an epic conversation. But anyway, so we're just more and more isolated from each other in a lot of ways, and everybody can be plugged into whatever they want now. Essentially, their own channel. You can choose your own facts on the internet if you want. You can download your own music. You can just go your own way, mm-hmm. And that's, you know, very troubling on a lot of levels.
And yet, it's touted as a heightened form of connectivity because we can connect with anybody all over the world. What does it mean when we can connect with people far away, but we can't connect with the people right here at home?
Yeah, I mean, we wrestle with that all the time. It used to be that if everybody lived in, say, the same town, everybody was more or less on the same page and knew what's going on. And now it's not true. There are people who know what's going on. There's people you talk to. But there's other people who are plugged into maybe some kind of community around the world or a community that they work in. And it's just different levels and different layers, and it's harder to find the commons. I think it can still be found. We have to sort of work to kind of create that, to find that.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Howard Mansfield about his wonderful book. It's called Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. Now, let's go on to dwellings and destruction. I know a little bit about this history because I've done a lot of work on World War II and it's one of my interests. And I don't think a lot of people really know about the firebombing, the incredible devastation of the firebombing that the Allies unleashed on Germany and Japan during World War II. But you actually start the chapter out with Vietnam, burning villages in Vietnam. So let's start there. Morley Safer broke the story. Tell us what that story was.
It might be the most famous couple of minutes of television ever aired. There in the year, and it's not like front of my mind, was it 1965 or 66? Anyway, early in the 60s, Morley Safer just filed this report from CBS News showing American GIs going into a village, lighting huts on fire, and, you know, killing people. And this just caused huge upset in the country. People couldn't believe it. They just denied it. They said either Morley Safer had staged it or given the Zippo lighters to it. And it's still today on the internet. You can go all over and read fierce denials of it as if that one image lost the war. It was just very upsetting to people, as it rightly should be. And it's emblematic of what war is about, which is about destroying your neighbor's house, destroying your neighbor's home, driving your enemy, that person, off the earth. It's just a visceral image, and that's why I think there's such strong denial of it. And it's just a basic level of dwelling, I think.
Well, describe that image a little bit more for us. What was happening? Because there were many, many instances of this. You know, what would happen when U.S. soldiers would go to a Vietnamese village and, you know, put their Zippo lighters to the roof thatch, and, you know, what was going on in the village?
See, you see people, women and children huddled together. You see them crying. You see old men there pleading. It's just a visceral confrontation.
Yeah. And that was their entire livelihood was contained in those houses.
That was their house. I mean, it's as if someone came and burned your house down. I mean, they're different kinds of houses, but that's it's just exactly that.
And all their wealth as well was contained in them. I mean, it's just searing to read. You say that what was on fire there was the old way. It wasn't just that we were burning down the houses of, you know, people who were incredibly poor on the other side of the world, but we were also setting fire to the old way of being.
That's the way it seems to me. There's a great quote by this historian, architectural historian named Reichert. He says, you know, paradise is a promise as well as a memory, and that we always have the hut with us, this memory of this kind of primitive hut. And I think that's one of the reasons why it resonated with people. I mean, in Vietnam, we waged this war against the earth. I mean, burning down forests, poisoning forests with ancient arch, bombing forests. It was just we've turned away from even thinking about that anymore. There's a wonderful historian, a Romanian historian of religion, the sacred, and I'm going to mispronounce his name, Marcia Eliade.
Oh, Mircea Eliade, yes.
Thank you, Mircea Eliade, who says that a dwelling contains the world. It's sacred, and it's a small map of the cosmos. And I think instinctively, when we look at bombed out images of Vietnam or Europe, that's what we're responding to.
Hmm. Well, in Germany too, you know, why did the Allies decide to firebomb the civilian populations of Germany so intensely? And of course, they weren't the ones who started. I mean, the Germans, you know, were the first ones to start that kind of massive bombing of populations. But what we unleashed in Hamburg and in Dresden, just...
Dresden towards the end of the war, and they tried to burn Berlin about 12, 14 times. This is a very... It's a complicated and knotty story. You keep, depending on how far you crank it back. If you go back to World War One, the Germans bombed a couple of English cities, Hull, and with from Zeppelins. And once that happened, during the interwar years, the promoters of air power... said, you know what, we have to, if we can go in and bomb the enemy next time so much, they will relent. We won't have that many soldiers come in. So air power was oversold. That didn't happen. What the British wanted to do was to bomb the Germans out of their house and then therefore stop wartime production, disorganize the economy. And they had it was a cabinet level paper. It was an official policy called de-housing. So we've always learned that, you know, you go in to bomb the ball bearing factory and you hit some houses. Well, actually, they were aiming for houses, and they developed a particular bomb. It's called the fire bomb, which weighs about, in some versions, 4.5 pounds, 6 pounds, really light. And it's designed to hit the roof, kind of land in the rafters and start a fire. And it was developed by fire engineers and chemists in the United States and in England. And we built different doom towns, different models of Japanese and German cities, and test bombed them in the Utah desert and also, I think, in the south of England, and to see how could you start the best fires. The entire policy didn't work. Many Germans were bombed out of their houses, which is some phenomenal amount. German wartime production just increased steadily up until the last part of the war, because it was just so much excess industrial capacity, apparently, and slave labor. And it's horrific. It's just horrific on a lot of levels. Obviously, the Allies were fighting against an enemy that was going to fight to the end. And, you know, it's very hard for a democracy. A democracy gets pulled into this and has to do things it doesn't want to do. Mm-hmm. I got into this whole thing in the book, not from the bombing end almost, but from the rubble end. I was reading three... I was reading three writers who I think are the most profound writers about dwelling. This fellow, Max Picard, who's a philosopher in Switzerland, no one's heard of, wrote this wonderful book called The World of Silence. And the book is like a found object. It's just an amazing description of silence. And then Gaston Bachelard, who some people know through his wonderful book, The Poetics of Space, which he says a good house is a daydreaming space. It's a place where we can, for reverie. And he wrote that book at the same time that Picard was writing The World of Silence. And then Heidegger, the famous philosopher in Germany, wrote this essay, Dwelling, Being, Thinking, I think. And I realized, oh my God, all these three guys, all these three philosophers are writing exactly when Western civilizations in ruins. And all of them, I think, are trying to say, how do you make a house sacred again? How do we make it safe to dwell again? How do we do that? And each, I think, has their own answer. You know, silence, dreams, or just this Heidegger's idea about being and letting the place be and letting the place have some kind of presence at that spot. Hmm. And that all, I think, comes right out of the war, because they're all writing when Europe's in rumble. And that's all, I think, in part, a result of the ferocious war that was fought in Europe and Japan as well. Because you go to Europe today, it's just everything's restored and looks wonderful. It's very hard to imagine and to get our minds back to how extensive that devastation was.
And what was lost. I mean, Heidegger is a very interesting case because I think, as you rightly point out, in some way he prefigured today's environmental movement. And back then, and even, you know, further back than World War II, you can look at the turn of the century, there was a whole conservative or even reactionary right-wing movement that, in fact, was saying, wait a second, there's something wrong about consumerism, about mass culture. We need to get back to our roots. But it led to a very different place than the environmental movement today. And you do talk about that in the book Dwelling, Howard Mansfield.
Yeah, there was a sense that, well, particularly when, to just pick up where we were, I guess, with Europe, when these cities were rebuilt, modern planners didn't like, you know, twisty little streets and small lots and all the things that today you would say is good urban design and good pattern. And so they further went in and rebuilt on a very soulless level and actually bulldozed even further. And people just, a lot of people just felt alienated and they wanted their old city back, and you can't get your old city back. But it was just a growing awareness that each place on Earth is unique unto itself, and that needs to be sought out, respected, cultivated if possible, whereas all the tendencies of the age are going the opposite direction.
Right. Then you talk about a Frank Lloyd Wright house in Connecticut, which I loved. I went online to look at it. I love Frank Lloyd Wright's architecture. Tell us a little bit about his vision, how he saw Dwelling.
Okay, yeah. We're talking about the Zimmerman House, which is in Manchester, New Hampshire. Oh. And it's owned by the Currier Museum of Art in Manchester. It's a wonderful house. If you come up and visit it, or come by and visit it if you're in the area. It's been beautifully curated. It's not a very big house. It's sort of like a larger version of his Usonian house, which he said would be a house for everybody. But the house is a complete object. Everything is designed in it, you know, from the silverware to all the finishes, and it's done. And you, the furniture, you live in it. It's not like when you live in this house, you're going to be thinking one day about adding a wing or updating the furniture, adding granite countertops. It's finished. It's surprising. It's on a corner lot in the city, yet once you walk into the house, it opens up to this backyard that it seems like it's acres and acres deep, and the outside seems to be part of the inside, and it's very liberating to me, and a beautiful object. And the Zimmermans who lived there were happy there, really enjoyed the house. And the house, they weren't like slaves to some kind of Frank Lloyd Wright vision. The house freed them to live their life. I say all that defensively because there's a huge division of a feeling about people who go to visit this house. Some people love it, and a lot of people hate it. They feel controlled by Frank Lloyd Wright's vision. They feel closed in. They just want to get out. Some of the rooms are small by modern standards. So strong reaction. And I think that reaction is that, you know, no home improvement. Their house is finished. You know, go live your life. And I think people kind of have a reaction to that. What do you mean we can't just, you know, go get a new carpet? Or what do you mean we're never going to build a wing here? You know, what do you mean we're done? I think that's the reaction to that house.
But wouldn't you want to make a house your own?
Yeah, to the Zimmermans, it was their own.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think there is that unsettling feeling that, you know, every Frank Lloyd Wright is somehow the third person or the fourth person in the house. I do think that is the question when you're there. You know, are you free to live your house as the Zimmermans, by all accounts I read, were, or do you feel like you're another? You're being curated by the architect. You know, you. That's the question.
Well, Harold Mansfield, this has just been such a delight to talk with you. We've just skimmed the surface of your wonderful book, Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. Thanks so much for writing this great book and for talking with us here.
Well, thank you, Francisca. I really enjoyed it. It was a great pleasure.
Howard Mansfield's book is Dwelling in Possibility. Read an excerpt at writersvoice.net. After the break, a different mirror for young people. Stay tuned.
As we go marching, marching in the beauty of the day, a million darkened kitchens, a thousand mill lofts gray, are touched with all the radiance that a sudden sun discloses. For the people hear us singing, bread and roses, bread and roses. As we go marching, marching, we battle too for men, for they are women's children, and we mother them again. Our life shall not be sweated from birth until life closes. Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In the second half of today's show, we move from home to homeland, our American homeland, and how it was woven together into a rich tapestry by the many strands of different cultures. As we approach the point where no one culture constitutes a majority, every ethnic group will be a minority, including whites, we need to give our children a better narrative than the one that's traditionally taught in schools, that America is white, Christian, and the bastion of freedom and progress. That narrative underpinned the assumptions of Fox News host Megyn Kelly when she asserted that Santa's white, he just is. My guest, Rebecca Stefoff, has published a wonderful volume for young people to counter that pernicious traditional narrative. It's an adaptation of Ronald Takaki's classic work, A Different Mirror, and it's aimed at middle and high school students. Stefoff tells the compelling stories of the Native American, African American, Mexican, Asian, and European peoples who together created this land, fought for justice, and brought their own cultural traditions to the mix. The book, out in paperback from Random House, is A Different Mirror for Young People, A History of Multicultural America. Well, Rebecca Stefoff, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
In this book, A Different Mirror for Young People, A History of Multicultural America, you took a book by Ronald Takaki and adapted it for kids. Talk a little bit about how that came about.
Well, I've actually done something similar to this years ago. For another of Ronald Takaki's books, I turned his history of Asian American immigration into a series called The Asian Americans for a publisher of books for young people. And it was the publisher's idea. He had read the book and thought the content was wonderful, and he wanted to make it accessible to middle school and high school readers. The book was called Strangers from a Different Shore. So he facilitated a meeting with Ron Takaki. I flew me out to San Francisco to meet with Ron, who lived in Berkeley. And we agreed on the idea and worked together for a series of books that wound up being, I think, 14 volumes, short volumes. And I loved working with him, and he was very happy with the adaptation. So that laid the groundwork for this much later project.
Oh, that's wonderful. I thought you made the history, and sometimes a very difficult history, very readable, and you included also a lot of stories, individual stories. Did they come from the original book, too?
Some of them did. One of the pleasures of working with Professor Takaki's book as source material is that He has a great interest. He had, I should say, he unfortunately passed away several years ago, but he had a very great interest in the personal experiences and stories of the people who collectively make up history. He was one of a number of historians, say from the 80s on, who really try to integrate individual accounts, primary sources, and narratives into the telling of history. And he was particularly interested in, you know, sort of the underbelly of history, not the generals and presidents and leaders who often are, you know, seem to be the actors in history, but ordinary people. So many of the individual stories and anecdotes that I used did come from his original source book. In some cases, I did a little research to flesh them out to find more details. And a few of the sidebars I actually did add to the book. They were either things that he mentioned only briefly in passing, or I, in fact, looked for. An example is the chapter about the Cherokee removal on the Trail of Tears. I found a story about a family who was very much involved in the Trail of Tears journey, and then also in leadership in the Cherokee Nation afterward, and researched that and wrote it up. So I did make a few original additions because we wanted to try to get some stories of young people into the book when we could.
Yeah, I was going to say that's one of the things that really draws one is many of these are stories of young people, and even some of them young people coming to this country as kids and then, or, you know, very young adults and then becoming, you know, very important in the history of immigrants. I'm thinking of Clara Lemlich, for example.
Clara Lemlich, exactly. She became very active as a union organizer and as a very young woman. I mean, she was a passionate and effective person, and she continued her activism, you know, throughout her very long life.
Yeah.
Ron very much liked the idea of his, I think he would have been very happy with this book, or happy that the book existed, because he was very, very much liked the idea of making this version of history, this perspective on history, accessible to young people. And part of the reason he was passionate about that is that he wanted young people to see that they too can be actors in history. You know, high school students who, for example, have challenged school district rulings on free speech grounds in court, or the young people who came out as illegal immigrants, undocumented aliens, because they were brought to this country as infants and are the drivers behind the DREAM Act. So young people really do have the ability to make a difference, and I think that we really wanted to highlight that in this book, and I think you would have been pleased by that.
And now to the book, A Different Mirror for Young People, and we're talking with the adapter, Rebecca Stefoff. The book is by Ronald Takaki, and Rebecca Stefoff, the original book, A Different Mirror, was by Ronald Takaki, and it's been adapted now for young people. So one-third of Americans today traces their ancestry to something other than Europe. And yet there's a master narrative about race that you talk about in this book.
Yes, I think that the master narrative is losing its hold on our sense of what it means to be an American, but it's still very powerful. And we see an example of this quite contemporaneously in the furor in the media and in pop culture over a particular newscaster's insistence that Santa Claus must always be portrayed as a white man.
In fact,
he's a completely imaginary figure and originally probably was of Turkish ancestry, you know, the origins of the real St. Nicholas. So we still have this sense that there are some things that are kind of fixed. They define our cultural perspectives. They define what it means to be an American. I'm happy to say I do think that that master narrative in which, you know, North America was colonized by white Europeans and they built everything and they created a wonderful nation and everyone else is the other, I think that that is weakening. I think that this Ron Takaki's work and the work of many, many other historians who've tried to present a more balanced multicultural view of our history, it's beginning to take hold, and demographics is, you know, I think that the master narrative is on the wrong side of history. The demographics is working against it.
Yeah, that's so true. And in fact, within the lifetime of many now alive, we will be a minority country. That is, nobody will have the majority position.
Exactly. I think we'll be a nation where everyone is on a more equal footing, because no one group demographically dominates the rest. What remains to be seen, and I think this will be very interesting, and I hope it's interesting in a good way and not interesting in a bad way, is whether that leveling of the playing field in sort of ethnic demographic terms can translate into social and economic egalitarianism, or into a greater degree of leveling of those playing fields as well. You know, we see in our economy that a very large percentage of our nation's wealth is in the hands of a very small percentage of the population. You know, I'm not an anti-capitalist, but there's a point where those imbalances, I think, become troubling. And so the mere fact that that white people will become a minority demographically in the near future may not translate into real social justice unless other things change along with it.
Yeah, and we should also point out that the book is about multicultural America, including European immigrants and Native Americans. In other words, the whole palette of different cultures, not just those that are not white.
Exactly. Professor Sakaki was a very firm believer that everyone's story is part of the big picture, and he certainly did not want to turn attention away from the extremely interesting and significant stories and contributions of white European immigrants, who also are part of the picture. In fact, one of the things that I think was most interesting about his book, A Different Mirror, and that I enjoyed delving into when I did the adaptation, was the way in which the experiences of many of these minority groups, including some white ones, were very similar. The Irish had to deal with many of the same issues that blacks who were in America, or that Asian immigrants who came to America, had to deal with. So there are certain similarities that all of these groups faced, and they have more in common than we might suspect looking back on our history today. And he wanted to see the picture of what America is include everyone.
So what were some of those ways in which Irish Americans had the same experience as black Americans?
Well, for one thing, they were very much regarded by the dominant white Protestant American society as the other. Most of the Irish who came in the great wave of immigration in the mid-19th century were extremely poor. They were fleeing desperate conditions of poverty and starvation in Ireland, and they were Catholic. So, and often they had not had much education. So because America conceived of itself at that time, or the people who were sort of the social and political leaders of the country, the elites, or the policymakers, very much thought of this as a Protestant country. Catholics were viewed with considerable suspicion, and so Irish immigrants were often discriminated against. There were signs in places saying no Irish allowed. They were given the worst jobs, typically most dangerous, dirtiest, lowest paying jobs. And they were pitted against, or felt themselves being pitted against, native-born African-Americans. They were competing for the same jobs, and often managers encouraged different groups to resent each other because they didn't want them joining forces in a labor movement. They wanted them to compete against each other and view each other with resentment to keep wages down. But they were both of those groups, and others too, were struggling against the same limitations.
There are a number of places where you talk about an active policy of setting one group against the other, you know, the kind of divide and conquer rule. One of the earliest was setting indentured whites in the colonies against blacks, especially there was a kind of class war.
Yes.
Talk about Bacon's rebellion and how that threat was met by the ruling class.
Yes, that was a very interesting era in our country's development, and an era in which choices were made, specifically in the Virginia colony, but choices that had a far-reaching impact. Bacon's rebellion grew out of the anger and resentment and disaffection of poor whites who either were indentured workers who had come to the colonies, or freed indentured workers. They'd served up their time and were free men, but they had nothing. Or they were farmers who did own land, but they had been shoved kind of to the periphery of the colonial society because they could not afford to buy land in good places near rivers. They were way out in the country, and, you know, they felt that they had gotten the short end of the stick because the elites had bought up all the land and used fairly ruthless methods in some cases to get it. And so there was a mass of people who, many of them had no rights in the colonial, to be represented in the colonial government because they didn't own land. And those that did own land were economically very disadvantaged. And this was you know, a kind of a powder keg waiting to explode. Now, prior to that time, the government of the Virginia colony had taken very strict measures to prevent any sort of cooperation or collaboration or fraternization between blacks in the colony, and they had imported some slaves and these disaffected whites. They didn't want them joining forces together. But when Bacon's Rebellion showed that the poor whites, basically, of the colony were angry and dangerous and capable of violence, the decision was made not to have more of those kinds of people, to stop bringing over poor white Europeans as indentured workers for the plantations, but rather to bring a mass quantity of African labor, which was a different sort of proposition, because by that time it was okay under Virginia law to own slaves. And so black workers could be controlled in a way that white workers could not be, and they were able to be kept separate. That was the idea. That was the solution. Rather than power sharing with the disaffected poor whites, they would just bring in more slaves to do the work that they couldn't rely on the whites to do.
And we're talking with Rebecca Stefoff about her adaptation for young people of Ronald Takacs's A Different Mirror. It's called A Different Mirror for Young People, A History of Multicultural America. Now, in this book, there's a lot about Native Americans, you know, the Trail of Tears, which you've mentioned earlier here, and many other instances of how, you know, Native Americans were treated and how their land was taken away from them. But one of the things I didn't know about was how the railroads had played such a huge role in the appropriation of Native American land and culture in the reservation system. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because it also connects with bringing in the Japanese and the Chinese.
Right, exactly. There were many workers needed for those railway projects. Well, the whole system, the whole process of building a railway empire in the 19th century is kind of remarkable. I mean, it was an amazing technological achievement. It's the sort of thing that in, you know, generations of school books for Americans is pointed out as a source of great national pride. It was a tremendous achievement. It knit the country together. It spurred economic growth and a sense of unity, and was an altogether good thing. All of those things are true, except that it was not an altogether good thing for everyone. The railway companies made enormous amounts of money. It was costly to build the railroad, but they got huge land grants from the federal government, many of them on Indian land. And those land grants were a source of great income to the railway companies for generations after the construction of the railroads was done. A lot of Indian lands were bisected or simply appropriated for the building of railroads along what were deemed to be the best routes. And as you mentioned, a lot of labor was imported to do the work, a lot of Chinese laborers and Japanese as well. There were also Irish and even Mexican workers who came to work on the railway building. And then after the railway system was done and, you know, the biggest building efforts were over, these immigrants were not treated well. I mean, they were not welcomed into American society. It was as though the country said, well, we have no further use for you, so now we're going to try to marginalize you as much as possible. So that was difficult, but perhaps the most lasting effect was on the native people because they simply were not able to continue in their traditional way of life, and that is something that was very much federal policy. When you look at the history of Native Americans and the U.S. government, it's truly a sad story because along the way, I mean, there were many just bloody-minded incidents of awfulness, but along the way, there were well-meaning white people, leaders, government bureaucrats, who wanted to try to do well by the Indians, and they simply were not able to get beyond the idea that the best way to help the Indians was to turn them into white people. That didn't work very well. It was a failed policy, but it kept being implemented over and over, and the railroad project was part of that.
And also, I think you get a very clear idea in this book, in A Different Mirror for Young People, how important immigrants of all different kinds of nationalities were for the creation of the labor movement. There were the Irish and the Jews. I'd like you to talk a little bit about that, but also the Mexican and the Japanese.
Oh, yes, very much so. The labor, we often think of the labor movement as kind of a triumph of you know, maybe the East Coast workers or the, you know, the workers in the cities of what is now the Rust Belt, but really it happened all over the country, and it happened a lot in the West Coast with agricultural workers or in the South. The labor movement was one place where, not always successfully, but often successfully, different ethnic groups were able to see their common cause and join together on terms of equality. And Professor Takaki was extremely interested in those times when various labor movements transcended ethnic rivalries and prejudice and opened themselves to members of different backgrounds working together, you know, combining forces, because they all were in the same position in a class war, but it was hard to see that sometimes because of ethnic and racial prejudice and rivalry. But once they united in, you know, in class terms, they made each other stronger, and so he liked to highlight those cases in which that happened, cases in which, say, Filipino and Japanese sugarcane plantations worked together, or Mexican and Japanese agricultural laborers. But the same thing happened with the Irish and the Jews in the East Coast. So that's one example of how Takaki felt that knowing more about our ethnic history, it might spur, you know, a sense of outrage or even anger, but he found also that there was a lot of room for hope and optimism because of all the many, many cases in which various immigrant and ethnic groups work together.
And there's also folks who did not come as immigrants. They were actually here and then became strangers in their own land, and not just Native Americans, but also the Mexicans. It's a very interesting story of how Texas and California just changed hands. And
yeah, without any input from all the many people who lived there. I think many Americans would be surprised. I see this when I do school visits. Kids in school are kind of shocked when they look at a map with a line drawn on it and see what a large percentage of our current continental 48 states was once part of Mexico. It was a pretty big chunk. And Mexico handed over all of that land as a result of a war which can be argued was kind of set up by the United States as a land grab. There are disputes on both sides of that question, and there probably always will be. Many, many episodes in history are capable of more than one interpretation. But at any rate, there was no doubt that the United States was very eager to get its hands on California and wanted Texas and the land in between as well. And so many thousands and thousands of people one day were citizens of Mexico, and the next day they were citizens of the United States. And they found themselves at a great disadvantage under the laws of their new country because many of them were not English speakers. They had trouble establishing citizenship. So that was quite a struggle. And it was a struggle that, as you say, they didn't get on a ship and come here expecting to have, you know, certain obstacles to overcome. The immigration sort of swallowed them up in a way.
So all in all, I mean, we are facing the whole issue of immigration reform now. It's a very hot issue, although the U.S. Congress seems to be dragging its feet on dealing with it. In writing this book, what are your hopes? What do you think is necessary for young people to know in order to forge a better way of us living together in a multicultural landscape?
Well, I think that what it is most important to know is that no one group is uniquely privileged as sort of the makers of American history. That history is really woven together from a lot of strands, and that things typically worked out better when there was more than one kind of person involved. That's kind of a vague generalization, but a lot of the most progressive aspects, the civil rights movement, for example, in the beginning was very much driven by both African Americans and Jews who had experienced their own horrors of discrimination and persecution in an earlier generation. So good moments such as that in our history often were the result, and the positive gains of the labor movement often were the result of different groups acting together. I think that what young people today should bear in mind is that what this country and every country needs is new sources of strength, ideas. We do not want the United States to become an insular country, you know, simply looking in on itself and trying to keep everyone in the same mindset or trying to have one group control the story of our history. You know, that shared input is always better. I think that would be Professor Takaki's view as well.
And I can attest to that civil rights struggle. My stepfather was a freedom rider. He was a rabbi. And I, you know, very much was inspired by everything I knew of the injustices through the centuries that had been done towards Jews to apply that to the injustices being done to others. So
that's a wonderful story and a great legacy, and you should be really proud of him. I mean, people put their lives on the line for what they believed in, and that is something we can all learn from.
Yeah. Well, Rebecca Stefoff, A Different Mirror for Young People, A History of Multicultural America, your adaptation of Ronald Takaki's book is just a delight to read and filled with new stories and information that is very thought-provoking. I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a great pleasure.
Rebecca Stefoff. You can read an excerpt from A Different Mirror for Young People at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.